Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, I'll chat with the star of the one-woman show Overlooked Latinas. Then a filmmaker follows women scientists trying to save bats from extinction. And we break down themes in Ryan Coogler's extraordinary film, Sinners. Today's show is about telling a different story of people and beings who have been misrepresented and forgotten. We're going to have a good time. That's all coming up next. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton. The play Overlooked Latinas has about a dozen characters, and they're all played by actress Tina D'Elia. So follow me. Overlooked Latinas is a show about a show. It follows two Latinx TV producers who are best friends, and they're pitching a pilot to NBC Studios in New York that pays homage to queer Latinx Hollywood legends who were blacklisted by the industry during the McCarthyism era. Now, one of the producers has just about as much drama going on in her personal life as the show she's pitching. I spoke with actress Tina D'Elia about her play that's currently running at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. Tina D'Elia, welcome.
Thank you, Janae Darden. So nice to meet you.
Yay. So nice to meet you, too. Before we even talk about the play, what got you into acting and comedy?
I will quote my friend Natasha Muse, who's a stand-up comedian. I kind of baptized myself, even though I'm not Catholic. While my sister was being baptized in one part of a church, I snuck into an altar, and I started to perform at the top of the altar. I knew that as a four-year-old, I wasn't allowed to do that, but I did. And what I was doing was I was trying to communicate to an audience that wasn't there. And I realized, like, oh, this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to speak to people and reach them and form a connection and perform and entertain, but also move and also have meaning in what I'm doing. And
yeah.
Where did the idea for the play come from?
Great question, Janae. So my third solo show is the Rita Hayworth of this generation. That was set in Las Vegas. The character, Carmelita Cristina Rivera, is a queer, high femme, Mexican-Italian performer who would like to be perceived as the Rita Hayworth of this generation. And she meets Angel Torres, a Puerto Rican-Italian butch lesbian, whom helps put on this show that Carmelita's doing. This is the backstory in this other show. She meets Angel at Mandalay Gay. And 5 years later, Angel is the protagonist of Overlooked Latinas. And she's excited. She's going to put on this show with her best friend, Carla Garcia, Overlooked Latinas. But who is going to play Rita Hayworth? Well, Carmelita of the past comes into the present again. When I started writing Overlooked Latinas in 2015, I had already been researching Dolores del Rio, Rosario Riveletes, Lupe Valles, Ramon Navarro, you know, and then prior to that for years, Rita Hayworth, who was born Margarita Cancino. I was really invested. Who are these Latinx artists? Who are these actors? Who are these women? Who are these trailblazers? Who are my ancestors? Who are my queer Latinx ancestors? Where did they come from? What are their stories? Particularly because I feel like our politics in this country always circle back to a form of backlash with McCarthyism.
And let me jump in here because just to explain a little further for people listening, these are Latinx actors, and they were, some of them, they ended up getting deported. They were accused of being communists, right?
Right.
They were blacklisted.
Yes.
And they couldn't work in Hollywood. I think was one that even couldn't work when they were deported back to Mexico for a while.
Right.
So in this play, you have these characters, well, as many characters, but you have, these friends, Angel and Carla, they're both Puerto Rican and Italian, so mixed race, queer. Carla's non-gender binary, and then Angel's lesbian. Yes. But Carla identifies as lesbian too, right?
Carla is sort of, I would say, kind of fluid. in their identity as a non-binary person. Yeah.
Okay. And so, yeah, so they're trying to launch this show about some of these Hollywood legends that you mentioned that haven't gotten their flowers in history. Yeah. And so aside from those two, well, let's talk about those two because they're friends.
Yes.
Yeah. And they've been friends for a long time. Very different personalities.
Very different.
Very different friends. Yes. Because Carla is like really timid and like...
It's true. I am. I'm a lot more timid. I do behind the scenes. It's true.
Yes.
I'm behind the scenes.
Whereas Angel Torres, I have to be the front facing person. I'm used to having to, you know, push things along. I'm having to put myself out there. And I've always wanted to be a director.
And I've wanted to work behind the scenes, making it happen. But I don't want to be in front of the camera. I don't.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, Carla always looks like, oh my God. It's like, they always look like, oh my goodness, oh my God. I'm like, relax, Carla, relax. I know it's a lot of drama, but relax.
Yes.
But they've been friends for a long time. And they're completely opposite.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Because Dear Angel looked out for Carla when Carla was being bullied when they were young. They're like 4'11". Mm. You know, they got picked on. They couldn't shoot the basket in the hoop. They were too small. And Angel came along and said, you know, let them alone. Let Carla alone. I'm going to just... Angel got a ladder, went up the ladder, and just brought the basketball net down so that Carla could shoot a basket. I realized as I was writing the show that in a way it is kind of like what would be considered in quotes like a buddy movie. You know, they're the ones that... You know,
it is
going to pitch the story together, put the story forth. They're going to support each other in whatever way they can. And, you know, and if it means that, you know, Angel's wife, the Lena Horne of this generation, is going to suddenly be in the show. And if it also means this other femme fatale, the Rita Hayworth, Carmelita, needs to be in the show, it's going to stress out Carla, but Angel's going to make it happen.
Lena's in LA,
yes,
while Angel and Carla are pitching this show to NBC in New York.
Yes, indeed.
And Lena wants to have a baby, and carries a turkey baster,
mm-hmm,
in case, I guess, sperm magically falls from the sky. I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know. She has a turkey baster waiting on hand.
Well, she's just looking for the most eligible bachelor there is, or the most eligible gentleman that has a high sperm count.
What was interesting about the relationship between Angel and Lena, I was thinking about, is how, you know, Angel, again, is Puerto Rican and Italian. And we know for those cultures, family is so important. Yeah. And Angel kind of is not on board. You can tell, yeah, not trying to really have a family right now because, you know, she's trying to get the show off the ground. Yeah. And it's interesting to see that struggle of, like, putting career before family.
This is Angel's dream, and
right. Angel's dream of having
a show and just being fully immersed in it. And I feel like as an artist, like in order for anyone to do that, there is a sacrifice. Right there, it puts her in a difficult spot because her baby is the show. And that puts her at odds with her wife, which is Lena's baby is having a baby. And I feel like maybe we don't always talk about as queer artists, like, what does it mean, especially, you know, being, whether it's being assigned female at birth, you know, the assumptions of what it looks like to be in coupleship and to say, I don't want to prioritize a baby right now.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with playwright and actress Tina D'Elia. Her one-woman comedy play, Overlook Latinas, is currently running at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley until May 10th. Tina, we've talked about a few characters. Yeah. 12 characters,
yeah,
you've counted, that you play. And you play characters that are like, that are part of the pilot and the, you know, the show that you're launching.
Yep.
You play characters that are Latinx legend, Hollywood legends that you are paying homage to. How in the world were you able to play 12 characters and like keep your sanity? And because like each, you know, all those characters have a backstory, right? Yep. That we are, as the audience, don't even know. And I know there's one scene where like half of them are in argument. And I said, how is How is Tina playing six people? And they're arguing.
Thank you for that question. That takes a lot of rehearsal, a lot of practice. But I would say that it all starts with, you know, the study of each character, because once I'm in them and I'm one person like Angel talking, say, to my wife, Lena, I'm thinking and feeling and being of Angel, you know, and maybe I'm proposing a question. So that means my brain is already Lena before I respond. So when I'm Lena in my mind, my body, everything is shifted and my eyes change, which is what the audience says. You know, my eyes change, my face changes, but it comes from what's going on inside me. You know, like, oh, well, I'm responding this way. You know, like suddenly I'm responding this way.
So it was really interesting to see how fast you can even switch, especially that one scene where it's a group of them arguing.
Yes.
And I was like, how is she doing that? Like,
yes.
You know, and there's a Jewish man in there, yep. You know, who works for NBC.
Yep.
So it's all different types of people from different backgrounds. Last question.
Yes.
You play all of these people. Who is most like Tina?
Oh my gosh, what a great question. Definitely, there's an inner Carla Garcia inside of me. So there's that young, quirky, sort of comedic and emotional and free spirit. But there is a part of me that has Angel. I take care of the people around me and I am protective. And I feel like that is my own homage to all of the amazing Butch Masculine of Center people in my life.
Thank you to playwright and actress Tina D'Elia. You can catch her show Overlook Latinas at the Marsh Theater in Berkeley now until May 10th. And later on, we're going to discuss the movie Sinners, but coming up, a documentary that explains why bats are really, really, really important for us and our planet. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. So bats, they don't have the best reputation. Many people find them scary, and definitely the COVID pandemic didn't help. But those who really, really know about bats understand how much they mean to the environment and to our health. And unfortunately, some of our furry flying friends are facing a disease that is pushing them to extinction. It's called white nose syndrome, and it has killed well over 6 million bats, 6 million. So you should be concerned, because what happens to them affects us humans. But there are scientists trying to keep these bats around, especially the little brown bats who were definitely decimated by this disease. So filmmaker Kristen Tiesch tells us about a group of female scientists working to save bats in her documentary, The Invisible Mammal. And the film will be screened at Docklands Film Festival this Saturday at the Smith Raphael Film Center in San Rafael. And Kristen joins me in studio.
Hey, thank you, Janae, for having me.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for making this film.
Oh, thank you for watching it.
It's a very, very, very important film. Before you made this film, what did you think about bats?
Well, the story is that I grew up in the Bay Area, so I grew up in Mill Valley, and the summers in Mill Valley are very similar to the summers in San Francisco, where it's very foggy. And so my whole life, I don't think I ever saw a bat or thought of them as something that are in our ecosystem every day or every night. And so it wasn't until I went to film school in upstate New York. I went to Syracuse University. And there was a pub that was on campus called The Incomplete.
Okay.
And we used to sit outside in the summer months having beers and just, you know, socializing with friends. And I think one night I thought I saw something fly over my head. I looked up and the sky was just filled with bats.
Oh, wow.
And as I mentioned, that was the first time I had ever seen bats in the wild, and, you know, in a natural setting like that.
Yeah.
And being somebody who was always an animal lover, of course I thought it was the coolest thing I had ever seen. And so that just stuck with that, you know, that experience stuck with me. Then flash forward 10 years later, I was back in San Francisco. It was 2009, and I was reading an article in The New Yorker by journalist Elizabeth Colbert, and it was about how bats were in trouble because there was this disease called white nose syndrome that was spreading across the continent and killing bats by the millions. Mm-hmm. And the epicenter of the disease was in upstate New York. So instantly I thought about the bats that I saw when I was a grad student in Syracuse, and I was like, wait, I wonder if they're still alive. You know, mm-hmm. I wonder if students can still sit out on that patio and have that same wildlife experience that I had. So reading the article, it really broke my heart. And I also had this kind of like this emotional reaction to it. Yeah. And I thought to myself, you know, this is a really interesting story and I'm going to follow it. And it was in 2019 that I started making the feature film.
Okay, and it took you 6 years.
It took 6 years to make the film. So 6 years ago, we started filming. I think our first shoot was in July of 2019 in mm-hmm. Texas at Bracken Cave.
Right before the pandemic.
Well, yeah, and then here we are, it's May of 2025, yeah. So almost exactly 6 years. But yeah, definitely we started planning, I think, about this time.
Yeah, and you filmed around the country. You filmed, and I'll say North America, I mean, because you filmed in Canada, like you said, Texas, California, on the East Coast. And the film follows several women scientists. Was that your intention? Did you want to specifically focus on women in the sciences who are doing this work to save these creatures?
Yes. So the answer is it was a surprise to me. When I first went up to Michigan, so I met Dr. Winifred Frick, mm-hmm. who's the chief scientist of Bat Conservation International. She lives in Santa Cruz, and yeah. she works also. She's a researcher at UC Santa Cruz.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so I met her. I found an article that was about a study that she was doing called Operation Fat Bat, which it intends to fatten up bats before they go into hibernation so they have a better chance at surviving if they're in a habitat that has white nose syndrome in mm-hmm. it, or the fungus that causes white nose.
Yeah.
So I read about this pilot project she was launching, and I was like, oh, that sounds really interesting. So I emailed her and I said, hey, I'd like to interview you. And then she invited me to go film with her and her team up in Michigan, Michigan Upper Peninsula. So and when I arrived, the first day that I arrived, I realized, you know, that her whole team was women.
And
it wasn't until that first day of filming that I was like, oh, this is not just a story about bats. This is a story about women in science, too.
Yeah.
I mean, if these are going to be my characters, you know, then throughout the course of filmmaking, I realized it wasn't just these three scientists, it's actually the whole field of bat science that's kind of dominated by women.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. It seems like it's just a field of science that women are drawn to, and maybe it's because there are women role models mm-hmm. that younger scientists see and see themselves, you know,
yeah.
in that role.
Because I remember one of the scientists that, you know, when she saw Dr. Frick giving a lecture or speaking at a conference or something, Dr. Frick, I think, was nursing her child
right.
or, you know, while she was giving a lecture. And now what I love about the film, too, is Dr. Frick brings her son. What's his name?
It's Darwin.
Darwin, of course. How convenient, right?
Right.
So, yeah, his name was Darwin. And, like, she takes him with him. And I love the joy. He shares her joy of bats. And I want to talk about, because we talked about the fat bat project. And then I just want to go over about what white nose syndrome is. Mm-hmm. So, bats stay cold during hibernation. Mm-hmm. And there's a fungus. The abbreviation is PD. It's a very long name. Y'all have to look it up.
Pseudogymnoascus destructans.
Hey, that's why she's a filmmaker. So short for that is PD. So it gets on their skin, and you see these little white dots on their little bodies. And then the fungus causes lesions on their skins. And so while the bats are hibernating, I guess the lesions make them wake up. Because I think if I had lesions on my skin, I'd be waking up.
Yes.
And so they're waking up too frequently, I guess, because their skin is irritated. And then this burns up their fat reserves that they've been saving during hibernation. And so they're burning fat. And so then when they wake up and it's still cold outside and snowing, there's no food. And so then they starve to death. So that's where the white nose syndrome. And then you see these little white specks on their nose.
Yeah, the fungus starts growing on their nose. And as you mentioned, it spreads to their bodies. And so what a lot of people don't realize is that the vast majority of bats in North America are bug-eating bats. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, when they wake up in the middle of a winter, there are no bugs around to eat.
Right.
So they're hungry because they've burned up all of their fat reserves. They're looking around to eat, and there's nothing to eat. So they drop down. And what happened, you know, when the scientists first started detecting caves and habitats, you know, with white nose syndrome, they would go in to do counts and surveys, and they would walk into the cave and the whole floor would be covered with bats.
Yeah, the bat bones, the bat skeletons from the ones that was, yeah, that when I saw that made me very sad.
Yeah.
Because they hibernate in clusters. So I didn't know, like, I didn't really know much about bats, but they hibernate in clusters. Like some caves, there may be a million bats in there.
Yeah.
So it's easy for the disease to spread.
Exactly. They're hibernating right next to each other, and once the fungus is in that habitat, it'll just spread really easily from bat to bat. And back to the bug eating part, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of people don't realize that bats do us a favor by eating so many bugs, right?
Right.
And so they eat their body weight in bugs every single night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So they really go to town.
They go to town. Imagine. I think one time I talked to one of the women in my film, Corky Quirk, mentioned, you know, it's sort of like a 100-pound human eating 400 quarter-pounders.
Oh, my goodness.
You know?
They're really fascinating mammals.
They are.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Kristen T. Esch about her documentary on protecting bats, and it's called The Invisible Mammal. And it premieres this Saturday, May 3rd, at the Docklands Film Festival at the Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael. This is a public health issue too. And you mentioned that in the film. There was a scientist from the University of Chicago who noticed there were higher human infant death rates in counties where there was white nose syndrome.
Exactly.
Because you know, we talked about bats eating bugs, and so they help farmers because they eat bugs that attack or eat the crops, and so farmers don't have to spend money on insecticides. And so, but when you spray the insecticides, it can spread into the water, our drinking water. Mm-hmm. And so that gets passed on to us.
Right.
And they save farmers in the agricultural business a lot of money too as well.
Right. So bats save farmers, let's start there, tens of billions of dollars in the United States mm-hmm. alone. You know, I think they save the corn industry like over $1 billion a year, just for that one industry, mm-hmm. you know. And so so when we think about bats, you know, we should think about them as these members of our shared ecosystem who do so much for us. And so this other fact that you were bringing up about the insecticides and their connection to infant mortality. Yeah, that was Dr. E.L. Frank from the University of Chicago. And his study was published, I think, late last year. Mm-hmm. And it shows that infant mortality rates went up, I think, 7.9% in the counties where white nose syndrome was present. Mm-hmm. And that's because when bats are not around and they're not able to help the farmers out by eating the bugs that would eat their crops, then farmers are forced to apply pesticides and insecticides. Not only does that also cost the farmers a lot of money, but then down the line, for sure, like we're the ones who live next to these farms or mm-hmm. drink the water systems that are, you know, that are near these farms, and so the insecticides get into our water supply and in the air.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that is one public health concern. The other public health concern that is brought up in the film is just the fact that we have we have encroached, humans have encroached on wildlife habitat.
Right.
And there's so little wildlife habitat left, you know, in the world.
Right.
You know, not just in our country, but everywhere.
Yeah, globally, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, so when the wildlife habitat shrinks, then there's more chances of encountering wildlife in human communities.
Right. It's funny because I've been noticing a lot of bear videos.
Bears.
I was like, I don't know if it's my algorithm on social media,
yes,
but I see these videos of bears coming into neighborhoods, like
right,
in Southern California.
Yeah.
And people are surprised, but I'm thinking like the fires. And I love what this one of the scientists said, like, you know, when you see these kind of changes or even like different diseases coming from animals, it's usually because it's humans' fault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I want to, we have a few more minutes. I want to talk about how beautiful this film is.
Oh,
so my producer Porfirio Rangel, he watched 15 minutes the first 15 minutes of your film. He had like pages of notes. So he
hopefully good notes.
They were great notes. So he enjoyed the film. I enjoyed the film. But visually it's beautiful. And you know, to see these bats, like I was like, oh, they do look kind of cute. But just, yep, you know, and he went under caves too. So can you talk about that? Like, so we have a couple of minutes, but
sure,
just talk about filming it and
sure. Well, as you know, bats, they come out at night.
Right.
And they're fast. Some of them fly up to 100 miles per hour.
Right.
And they're tiny. You know, they're just a few ounces. So they're very hard to film, really. You know? So when I was first interviewing Dr. Frick, she mentioned that she actually knew a bat cinematographer, somebody who specializes in filming bats. And he's from Austin, Texas. His name is Skip Hobby. And you know, because Austin is a great town to see bats in.
Mm-hmm.
He's had so many encounters and experiences. You know, being able to film the bats there, and you want somebody who knows what they're doing.
Right, right.
So as soon as Fred told me about Skip, I knew that he was the person that I wanted to hire to film, you know, these beautiful scenes. We wanted to make sure that when people watched this film, they would walk away having seen bats in a whole new light.
Yeah.
In a way that they had never seen them before, in slow motion with a beautiful, like, sunlight in through their wings.
Yeah, and you all captured all of that. And then, too, and we have to wrap up in a few seconds, but also, too, just seeing people like nurse bats who...
Oh, yeah, Corky.
Yeah, she's in Sacramento.
Corky, the bat rescuer.
She's in...
Yeah, Davis.
Yeah, so she's in
the
Davis.
Bat rescuer. She rescues these little baby bats and rehabilitates them and releases them back to the wild.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film. I learned so much. I know Porfirio learned so much. So thank you. I really, really encourage people to go see it. Thank you so much, Chris. Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, come back anytime. I've been speaking with filmmaker Kristen Tiesch. Watch her documentary, The Invisible Mammal, this Saturday during the Docklands Film Festival at the Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael. And next up, two Bay Area writers and I break down some of the themes in the movie Sinners. And we promise we won't bite, so keep it locked right here. Me, Janae Darden. The movie Sinners has so far made $161 million worldwide at the box office, and that's according to the BBC. Oakland's own Ryan Coogler wrote and directed this film that's about twin brothers who are World War I veterans. They moved back to segregated Mississippi in 1932 after living in Chicago to open a juke joint. But vampires are lurking, and on the opening night of their new spot, all hell breaks loose, literally. Sinners is not your typical horror movie. There are so many themes in this film: racism, religion, colonization, freedom, passion. And here to dig more into this film are writers and my friends, Audrey T. Williams. She's the co-chair of the World Fantasy Convention that's coming to Oakland in 2026. And poet Nazila Jameson, and she hosts the Berkeley Poetry Slam. See, I'm stumbling because I'm so excited to talk to them. And in her spare time, she writes horror screenplays, which kind of surprises me, but does it? At the same time, Nazila and Audrey, welcome.
Hi, Janae. Thanks for having us.
Glad to see you. Nazila, you there? I can't hear Nazila. Oh, unmute yourself, Naz.
Now, I'm Jesus. Why?
Okay. Now we can kind of hear you. Okay. I've seen the movie twice. How many times have y'all seen it so far?
Twice.
Naz. Twice? Okay. It's definitely a movie you have to see more than once. And I saw it with Naz in the theater. I take it you both love the film.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, 100%.
Okay, great. Okay, so Naz, the first thing you said, because Naz and I saw it with a group of friends, the first thing you said when you saw the movie, when the movie opened, we see a character, his name is Preacher Boy, or Sammy, his father is a minister, and he wants to play the blues, and his father doesn't want him to play the blues, because back in the day, the blues was called devil's music, and so he wanted him to play, you know, gospel music, but he looked like somebody to you, Naz, that is a real blues player. Tell us who he looked like to you.
Oh my God, now his name is leaving mine.
Robert Johnson.
Exactly. So Robert Johnson was a musician around the same time as this movie takes place in. And he's legendary because, first of all, he was supposedly one of the best blues guitarists ever. And his career was all of, I think, 6 months a year.
Right.
He died when he was 27 years old under mysterious circumstances. When I did a little research, apparently there's a death certificate, but no cause of death, and nobody figured that out. But it was rumored, I think when he was still alive, that he made a deal with the devil to get that good guitar talent. And that basically when he died, the devil was coming to get paid.
That is the myth. Yes. So that's the myth, that he made a deal with the devil. And then Ryan Coogler, I saw an interview where he said he did some research, and then supposedly he made what he learns, that he made a deal with some West African deity. That's also a myth. So we, you know, of course, we don't know. I don't have to know what happened. I'm going to leave that alone.
Is it a myth?
That's why I said I'm gonna leave that alone. But that is part of the inspiration for this film. So, which takes place in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I know you and Audrey, y'all both are from the South, even though you live here in the Bay Area. And it's something too about the South, as far as being this place that is both beautiful but haunted. You want to speak on that, Audrey?
Sure. I mean, I was raised in North Carolina, but my father is from Arkansas. And so I know that he and all his brothers and sisters and his parents, they were all sharecroppers. So those opening scenes where you see those wide expanses of the cotton fields, and there's, you know what? I don't, stop me if I'm doing a spoiler.
Oh yeah, I forgot to say, this is a non-spoiler interview. So we're going to be as non-spoiler as possible, but go ahead.
Let me be general about it and just say that even though I know that was my father and his family's lived experience, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that some of the scenes showed me an inner, sort of an insider's view into things my father and my aunties and uncles had not described to me, like how large the cotton bags were that they were expected to fill every day, things like that. So I think from a historical perspective, you know, as folks have said, like the movie works on so many levels and hits home for me in ways. And also them going up to Chicago, my father's family was part of that great migration that went from Arkansas to the suburbs of Chicago. So
yeah. Really. And you're referring to, you know, when they're out there picking the cotton because they're sharecroppers. And so they would have this big bag that they had to fill with cotton, you know, to get money. They had a quota, you know, and it was a lot. So they were out in the sun. My grandmother, rest her soul, she's from rural Mississippi. And so she would pick cotton for her family farm. And I remember she, you know, talked about how hard it was, especially too, because it's prickly. And so I thought about her too when I was watching that film. I want to bring up another scene since we're talking about being out in the fields. And there was a scene, Audrey, where we see another Bay Area legend that we love in film, Delroy Lindo. And he plays Delta Slim, who's a blues singer who's an alcoholic. And there's a scene where he's in a car with Preacher Boy and one of the twins, and he's riding past the chain gang that are working in the films, and he recounts a friend who was lynched. And as he's recounting the what happened, like Ryan Coogler with his storytelling, like weaves in music, right? And so we don't actually see what happened, but we get an idea of what happened through the music. And so Delroy Lindo starts singing a blues song as he's telling this traumatic event. And when I saw that scene, I said, "That's the blues. That's the blues." Right there. That's why the blues was created. And I was surprised when I heard that Ryan Coogler wasn't going to even have that scene in there. Delroy Lindo had to, you know, push and encourage him to include it. What about that scene moved you?
So I also saw that interview where they said they had to fight for that scene to be included. And I'm just so glad that they did, because that he said that that's what we actually see in the film was pretty much improv. So what happened was he's recounting the story of how his good close buddy got lynched. One of the things that first struck me, you know, usually in movies, there's always sort of some kind of ambient background music.
Right.
But instead, and again, I don't think this is a spoiler.
It's not a spoiler. Go ahead.
Instead of background, you know, the score or the soundtrack of the movie, what we hear is a very detailed audio of what is happening. So you hear the white men go in and grab his friend. You hear the rope. Right. You hear the rope tighten. And you hear his friend and his final death struggle as he's telling the story verbally. And so when he gets to the last part of it, which... this might be a spoiler.
It's not a spoiler. Go ahead.
He's castrated, right? Yeah. And so when he says that, it's like, there's nothing left to say after that. And so there's no more words. And so that's when he starts the humming and he's like,
right.
And he starts, you know, clapping. And it's like, there's so much pain and so much trauma in that moment. There's nothing left to do but let it move through your body. And what I realize is like, that's the original somatics. That's the original, like, music as expressive arts therapy. He took all the pain and the trauma and he was like, used movement and used his vocal cords and that vibration, that like, he moved it through.
Right.
And that, exactly what you said, Janae, that was the blues. That's how we did it.
And I want to bring Nazila in too. I know you want to say something. I'm also thinking too, Nazila, just from you being from the South and, you know, I'm thinking about the church too and how the church influenced the blues. But go ahead, say what you were wanted to say.
That's what I was going to say. Like, that's something that I witnessed growing up in real time. I was a preacher's daughter. And my dad died when I was, like, really young. But my mother was a preacher's wife. So we got invited to, like, all the funerals of all his parishioners. And his whole affect, the remembering and the grief and the hum, that is something that I witness in church with people's moms and like kids when, you know, they're, it gets to a point where it's not sobbing anymore. It's just, and they kind of go in on the humming, almost as a natural effect. It doesn't even start out as a song. Like, that's something that I noticed too from the film with Delroy. The hum didn't start as a song. The hum started as like, just a release on its own, and then he continued into a song.
Yeah.
But I know that hum. I've seen that hum.
Oh, like, yeah.
In church as an expression of grief or pain, or in my mother's case, sometimes anger that you didn't want to, you know, necessarily express on somebody.
Girl, that's the healing hum. It's the healing hum.
I would tell y'all, when I first lost this show a month ago, I was humming too. It's a lot of work launching a radio show.
Yeah.
Porfirio knows. My producer, Porfirio Wrangle. Since we're talking about the church, definitely a huge theme in this film is religion.
Yeah.
We see Christianity, we see hoodoo, and hoodoo is portrayed in a way that's not stigmatizing. You know, speak on that, Nazila and Audrey, please. What are thoughts that come?
I'm originally from South Carolina.
All right.
And you know we have roots.
That's right.
Which is basically hoodoo. I think that places like, so South Carolina is one of the, I forget what they call them, but sort of weight stations. Mm-hmm. It was one of the bigger ones, like that they shipped enslaved people. They shipped Africans from Africa to South Carolina. They sat there and then they shipped them off into the rest of the United States. But they gathered them from, like, the South Carolina had Africans, the most Africans from the same region in Africa, which is Angola. Mm-hmm. So basically, it was a bunch of, in fact, to the point where, like, you've heard about Gullah Island. Gullah was basically an unsupervised plantation because they all knew each other. They spoke the same language. It turned into sort of a really productive farm. And it got to the point where they didn't necessarily even have overseers most of the time. They would just stop by every couple weeks, month, and pick stuff up and leave. Mm-hmm. And they would live that way. So because of that, though, they preserved a lot of the traditions from Africa, mm-hmm. which is how we got root. And that resonated a lot with me because I grew up, you know, like there's the church, but African religions often in most parts of the world were right beside the church. People renamed their gods into saints. Right. People renamed the religions into prayers, and they still practiced. But my great-grandmother was a witch doctor, and she mm-hmm. basically, like, had all the salves and did all the rituals and all the things. And so, yeah, that part of this film really resonated with me because I know a couple things. I don't necessarily practice them all the time. But you grow up with that, and it's just naturally in your community. It's not stigmatized. Just like the little girls went there. They just was casually there.
Yeah, it was little girls that went to visit Annie.
Exactly. To pick up stuff for their mom. Like going to the store. Like, it's just such a natural part of the South, of, like, Southern states and Southern. It's alongside the Christian religion, basically.
Audrey, could you, the way you look in. People can see.
I mean, we could do a whole show on this. Like,
just just on that religion and right.
Right. I mean, so I grew up on the coast of North Carolina. And first of all, you mentioned, Nazila mentioned the Gullah Geechee. I just want to say that there is an amazing writer, Eden Royce. She is from Charleston, South Carolina, and she does middle grade and young adult and now adult horror that is set in deep in Gullah Geechee culture. So I just want to throw her name out there because we can't talk about Gullah Geechee and Black women writing horror and not talk about that. So the scene, again, no spoilers, but the part in the hoodoo cabin, I wish we could just have a whole movie that's set inside that cabin. As they kind of panned around, there were things that are sort of known entities. Like, I saw, first of all, I was like, oh, she's supposed to be doing hoodoo. There's certain things that if I'm gonna believe this, I'm gonna need to know that they consulted with somebody that knows what they're doing. Like, the first of all, the door frame better be blue. And it was. It was haint blue because that's the color that makes sure the haints don't come in. The haints are the ghosts.
Hold on. And then I'm thinking of you saying that, and one thing I noticed about the twins was that Smoke wore blue.
Robin Blue, he did.
Yeah.
Because Annie probably told him. You saw her necklace. She always had those beads. She had that shade, haint blue. It's a specific color, right? So there was that. There was Florida water. When the little girl came, she said, Mama said, you know, let me get some High John. Like, that's an actual, like, herb. Like, these are the real, you could call them herbal remedies, folk medicine, whatever you want to do. But there's things that exist, you know, like the bombs and the salves, as Nazila mentioned. So it did my heart good to be like, okay, they're legit. Like, they took their time, they researched it. So yeah, there's that. And then speaking to the spirituality, I don't know, I don't want to jump ahead, Janae, but like, it makes me think about the big scene that everyone talks about, the musical number, because the combination of the Yoruba and some of the African, the West African spirituality.
So let's pause right there. So there's a scene, semi-spoiler alert, but there's a scene because these vampires are after Preacher Boy because he has this gift where when he plays music, it opens up these realms from the past and the present and the future. And so the vampire, he wants Sammy. And so that scene is resonating with so many people. And so go ahead. So yeah, there's a scene. And yeah. So we see how Black music has transcended and has traveled from the continent to the present. Right.
Okay. Yes. So I was just going to talk about what Nazila mentioned about how there's Christianity alongside of the West African traditions. And one of the ways that I noticed they brought that through, it's through the ages, right? It's like there's this timeline of how the beat, the rhythm has evolved from our ancestors up through today. And as they're showing the different genres of dance, you know, I noticed there's like, it goes from like crip walk to candomblé. And candomblé is like a combination of the African traditional religions and Christianity. And so just to say, the ways, the unique creative ways that they found to show how rhythm and movement and beats come through, even in, you know, the music, whether it's secular or religious / spiritual music, like it's genius the way they brought it all together.
Nazila, you want to say something?
I was going to say that I read a couple of different things. One of the things that I read, though, was that Wumi Masaku, who played Annie, did research. She actually went and hung out with hoodoo priestesses or practitioners and really studied so that she could get everything, like the rituals and everything, right herself. And apparently it's authentic enough that some groups of people who will remain nameless actually, I mean, and maybe you want to get into this. I don't know if you do today, but there has been some controversy among our brothers and sisters who are very Christian about the, you know, the spiritual legitimacy of this film. And one part that they were like really up in arms were, that I guess she was so authentic that they were like, she's practicing it right now. And if you go and see the movie, then you will have been practiced on. And I'm like, okay.
I've been hearing some of that. I've been hearing people, yeah, because hoodoo's in there because it's a vampire movie. They don't want to see it. I have heard some of that. I can't believe we only have 3 minutes left.
What?
I know. And this is we've been talking for 22 minutes. I might actually do a full hour maybe when it goes to streaming, and then like just have, and like, you know, we can like talk about this film.
Yeah.
Okay, but I just want to say something real quick. Since we're talking about Annie, we're talking about Wunmi Mosaku, the actress who played Annie, who plays Smoke, the twins, his lover. I just was so happy to see a dark-skinned, curvy Black woman who is desired, who held it down, you know, smart, beautiful, sexy, and sacred. And also to Jamie Lawson too. So I was happy to see, you know, Black women of different complexions. But you know, dark skinned sisters, we don't always get our props. So I was really happy to see those sisters. I was very happy to see that. Shout out to Perlene. I was about to say, I don't know how the church folks felt about Perlene, but yeah. So Perlene was pearling. I just say this. It's the reason why her name was Perlene. Yeah. But I'm going to keep my job so you can you figure that out. All right. We only have 2 more minutes left.
Okay, one thing regarding Annie. I love that she was a dark-skinned, full-figured woman. I never see myself on film. It was awesome to see a dark-skinned woman in a love interest part. Yeah. Also, it was lovely to see an age-appropriate couple, because people are so used to Hollywood with these, like, women leading ladies that's 20 and 30 years younger than the man, that they've taken it as something that's the norm.
Right.
And it's really nice to see two people the same age get together.
Yes, yeah. See, I didn't even think about that. So even looking at, like, how this film pushes back against ageism, too, as well. Mm-hmm. We haven't even, like, we have like 1.5 minutes left, right? I know this is, it went by so quickly. We haven't even gotten to talking about the vampires, which brings the question, is this a horror film? Because look at all the things we've talked about, and we haven't even, we've barely scraped the surface on the monsters, which also makes me wonder what is a real monster? I've heard people say the monster is capitalism. I've heard people say the monster is colonization. Some people say the monster is a monster. But is this a horror movie?
It's historical horror. It has been maybe made fantastical to be more palatable to the masses. But the bulk of it is the truth of what happened told through metaphor. It's his creative genius. He alchemized the historic, horrific traumas that our people live through, to me.
Naz?
Portrayal of vampires.
Say it again.
I said great portrayal of vampires.
Okay.
It had all the elements of vampires, and they were done quite well. So it is legitimately a vampire movie.
It's all the things. Okay.
And they did it fully. Like, you know what I mean? It was full representation. Like, I'm not going to spoil, but they had all the vampire tropes. It was great.
Okay, so we're going
to... Including, the invite them in.
Okay, awesome. So we'll have to end there because it's, I know, it's so much more to talk about, but we have to end because the show's about to end.
Okay,
I appreciate y'all. We're going to do this again in about a month or so. We're going to come back, maybe bring some extra folks and just have 1 hour with spoilers. All right. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with writers Audrey T. Williams and Nazila Jameson. Sinners is in theaters now, and you can visit the Sights and Sounds page on KALW.org, where I have a list of resources related to some of the themes in Sinners. And that is all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, don't invite people in who asked to be invited. And if you saw the movie, you know what I'm talking about. Eat your garlic, be good to yourselves and each other. Thank you.